From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mark Richard's first novel, Fish Boy, has been described as maritime gothic, a surreal voyage of the damned, and an eloquent fever dream. It's the story of a boy left in a swamp to die, who stows away on a trawler manned by a giant, a murderous pedophile, and a couple of convicts. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Richard about his own experiences at sea. Remember Jack Sheldon from the Merv Griffin Show band? He played with the band for 18 years. But that's not the reason we invited him on our show. When you hear his new record, I think you'll understand why. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House, the House, and the Senate are frantically looking for a compromise that all of them can accept on the president's budget proposal. The White House is withholding its endorsement of the tentative compromise worked out on the Hill today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Senior White House officials say they're waiting to see the details of the tentative agreement worked out by Senate Democrats. They say the White House will withhold its endorsement if the newly configured energy tax and the accompanying Medicare cuts do not meet the president's criteria of progressivity and fairness. White House aides caution that whatever is worked out to get the votes of conservatives and moderates on the Senate Finance Committee, once the bill gets to conference with the House, a compromise will have to be worked out to satisfy the concerns of the more liberal House members. Today, President Clinton was focusing on the broad principles of his economic plan. He told a group of business executives today that deficit reduction was the big issue. He claimed that his plan had been distorted by his Republican opponents and insisted that it included an equal balance of spending cuts and tax hikes to reduce the deficit. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Congressional Black Caucus has turned down a White House request for a meeting tomorrow, expressing its displeasure with proposals to cut Medicare and Medicaid in the compromise tax bill. Caucus Chairman Kwaisi Mfume said black lawmakers are concerned that the compromise would gut programs that are important to minorities and the poor. The Maryland Democrat said the decision not to meet with President Clinton was unanimous. The Congressional Black Caucus threatened to withhold support from the president after he withdrew the Justice Department nomination of Lonnie Guinier. Magistrates in Rome have asked the Senate for permission to proceed against former Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti. As Francis Kennedy reports from Rome, Andreotti is suspected of having ordered the murder of Italian journalist Mino Pecorelli.
When Pecorelli was killed in 1979, he was believed to have important information on the kidnap and murder of Prime Minister Aldo Moro, information which could have incriminated leading political figures. That case was recently reopened after mafia turncoat Tommaso Buscetta accused Giulio Andreotti, seven times Prime Minister, of having ordered the mafia to murder Pecorelli. Reports from here say the judges also have other evidence to back up their accusations. Senator Andreotti described it as an attempt to lynch him, saying he wanted the matter cleared up as soon as possible. The Senate last month allowed magistrates to proceed against Mr. Andreotti on allegations that he was the mafia's political protector in Rome. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about a point to close at 3,512. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of 242 million shares. This is NPR. There were reports of new attacks on foreigners in Germany today, including arson attacks on a refugee center and a car belonging to an asylum seeker. U.S. Ambassador Robert Kimmett said today in Berlin that the German government must take stronger action to prevent violence against foreigners. Kimmett said that the German government should consider some of the police methods used in the United States. He gave no details, but he was thought to be referring to eavesdropping methods, which are severely restricted in Germany. A new AIDS therapy developed by a team of scientists headed by polio vaccine pioneer Jonas Salk was the center of attention at the 9th International Conference on AIDS in Berlin. But the attention was not all positive. NPR's Joe Palka explains.
Jonas Salk is trying to make his mark on AIDS. He and his colleagues have developed an AIDS vaccine, not to prevent AIDS, but to treat people who are already infected with the AIDS virus. At both a scientific session and then later at a press conference sponsored by the company developing the vaccine, Salk and his colleagues claimed that the patients who were injected with the vaccine had less virus in their blood after a year of therapy. But many scientists attending the meeting here were highly skeptical. They point out that most scientists with mildly encouraging data don't call press conferences or hire public relations firms to broadcast their message. And many suggested that if Jonas Smith instead of Jonas Salk had done the study, it would never have gotten on the conference program. In Berlin, I'm Joe Palka.
The Consumer Product Safety Commission voted today to require that disposable butane lighters be made child-resistant. The commissioner said the regulation could save most of the 150 lives now lost each year in fires started by children playing with lighters. The new regulation requires that disposable lighters be made too difficult to be operated by most children under five. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After winning the Penn Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award for short stories, my guest Mark Richard went on to write his first novel, Fishboy, which has just been published. The New York Times Book Review called it an extraordinary first novel. In Esquire, it was described as an eloquent fever dream, a tale told headlong in the language of incantation. As you'll hear, Mark Richard has had a pretty interesting life, some of which is the basis of his surreal novel, Fishboy. The main character, Fishboy, is a boy abandoned in a swamp who stows away on a trawler manned by an idiot, a giant, and a pedophile. We'll start with a short reading.
In this scene, this is early in the book, where two members of the crew have been fighting for the better part of the day with axes. It's the first mate and the cook. And the main character, Fishboy, has been sitting up in an osprey nest at the top of a drainpipe watching the whole proceeding, and it has come to its inevitable gruesome conclusion with Lonnie having firmly planted his axe into the cook. And they're both at the after deck, and Fishboy is still up in the nest, at which time Lonnie says, "You," said Lonnie, pointing a bloody finger at me, "get me a wrap or a towel or a blanket if you have one." Inside the fish house were some oyster sacks, and I meant to pitch one on deck as I passed, but Lonnie said to fetch it to him. "I'm so cold, Lonnie," the cook said. Lonnie told the cook that it would be all right, the cook's violent shuddering arms throwing off the comforting cover of Lonnie's shirt so that Lonnie had to hold it down. "Bring that wrap up to me," Lonnie said, and I walked a spring line aboard and I swung the rail. The oyster sack seemed small when I pressed it on the cook, fitting it like a bib napkin, as if the cook, who smelled of wet herbs and old seasonings, was preparing to eat. The cook said he was sorry to Lonnie, sorry to cook his eggs so greasy, sorry to salt the coffee, sorry to make stew from boiling his apron, sorry to blow snot into the beans, sorry that he was the cook at all, saying he had always wanted to be a blacksmith, but that he was frightened of horses, and Lonnie said that it was all right. The cook shuddered, and I pressed the oyster sack against him to keep his inside things from sliding out. The cook felt my pressure and looked down at me. "Never learned to cook," the cook said to me, and I shook my head that I never would. The cook said that he was cold straight down the middle. Could Lonnie get him a nice piece of felt blanket? And Lonnie said sure, and held the cook tighter. Lonnie did not fight the quaking arms as they rose and fell against us, Lonnie letting one arm finally reach around his neck, as I felt the other pull me deeper into the divide of the big split body. "I am so sorry," said the cook, and Lonnie said that it was all right. It was all right, and Lonnie closed us tighter inside the cook's suckering, still embrace.
Okay, Mark, let's eat.
let's have some beans.
The axe fight in this book was based on a real fight that you observed on the show?
Well, it was something that happened. I had dropped out of college to work on these trawlers, and a lot of times you'd put in these remote fishing villages along the coast, and the worst thing you can be called is college boy, but they found out that I'd been to college a little bit. So I was kind of putting together the logs at the end of the trip. I would have to chart the courses. I would have to kind of program the Lorans and stuff like that. And at the end of the trip, this one particular trip, the captain and I were sitting at this galley table with $100,000 in cash laid out over the table, and I was figuring up the crew shares. And he had this big Navy-issue Colt 44 on the table, because when people knew you were paying out, they would try to, they would come and rob you. And the first mate came stumbling into the galley with a big split lip, and he reached for the gun, and the captain said, what do you want this gun for? And the mate said, well, I'm going to shoot the cook. And the captain says, you're not going to shoot the cook with this gun. And the mate said, well, give me something to kill that son of a bitch with. So the captain got up from the galley table and went over to the oven. And above the oven, there was this enormous fire axe. And he pulled this big fire axe down and handed it to the mate and said, here, use this. So the mate walked out through the hatch, and I'm just sitting there kind of dumbstruck with the money in my hands, frozen, and the captain said, I hated those greasy eggs, too. And in the meantime, the cook on the deck had picked up a big sledgehammer that had an old piece of axe welded to it, and these guys went after it all afternoon fighting on the deck to the crew's amusement. You know, there was no one to stop them.
Who survived?
The mate survived. Well, they both sort of survived, but they were pretty much rough shape after that. They both were carried off.
You volunteered to be on a ship like this?
I think I did. I had spent 3 summers before working in a paper mill, which I really hated, and some friends said, you can go work on these boats and make as much in 1 week as you can make in the whole summer at the paper mill, which was completely a fallacy. You can't do that. But I bought into it as a romantic notion. So I went down to the sea and worked, finally got on the boats. By the end of summer, I'd made a little money, but not enough to go back to school. But I enjoyed doing it. And the only boats that would let me on were these kind of rough boats, where they needed college boy crews and people from jail.
College boys and people from jail?
Yeah. Well, if they didn't have the crew by the time we're ready to ship out, the captain would take a big wad of money down to the jail. And he had an arrangement with the sheriff where he would bail out people, and the sheriff would bring them down to the boat in handcuffs and chains and sign them over to the captain. And it was a good deal for them. They got to get out of jail. They got to work and earn a little bit of money. And when they came in, they may have earned enough money to make their bail. So, you know, you don't know who you're working with sometimes, these guys that they would come and unlock the handcuffs. Some of it was just, you know, house burglary. Some of it was attempted manslaughter. You never knew who your people would be that you'd be working with.
Did you read a lot when you were working on ships?
You know, it's surprising. Those guys read a lot, and they will get a bunch of paperbacks. You never know what would be on these boats. You would have romance novels and Steinbeck and all these books, and they would take the books and rip them into several parts, like a paperback. They'd tear into 4 parts, and then one person would read the beginning and then pass it around so that you would. The problem is, invariably, you'd get someone who would be reading the middle of the book, and they've been reading these 8 pages for 2 weeks, and they're the type of reader who their lips move, and you're just going, when will I ever get that section of the book? So sometimes you would have to read the book not in sequence. I remember I read East of Eden almost backwards. I read the back, and then I read something in the middle, and went back and forth, because that was the only literate book that was on this particular boat.
You went back to school, went back to college after your 3 years aboard the boats.
Right.
How did you fit in afterwards? You were probably older, and also it had this series of adventures that most of the students, I'm sure, had not had.
Yeah, it was not a good fit. I went back, and I had a beard and long hair, and actually I had this woman in tow that I'd met in Key West, and this was a college where it was coat and tie to class. So I just lived in an old farmhouse out in the country, and got very serious about my work, and finished up, and then got out hyper time.
You've had a lot of unusual jobs in your time. You've also worked as a public investigator, a bartender, a teacher. I guess there's nothing particularly unusual about any of those jobs. It's just altogether. But the one I'm actually, the job I'm most interested in is hearing about your editing Military Business Review.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I have a friend who now writes for a lot of magazines who once applied to edit something called Business Forms Monthly.
Right.
We were thinking about what what kinds of big controversial issues the magazine covered. What did you have to cover in Military Business Review?
Well, I actually started the magazine when I was a reporter for the...
started the magazine?
Yeah. I worked for the Navy News, and I kept finding... I was doing a story on the Naval Supply Center, which supplies the Navy with... It's the world's largest department store. You know, you can go in there and get aircraft engines and milk and whatever you need. And... After I did the story, I realized that there was no way for people would ask me, how do I sell my product to the government? And this is at the exact same time that the $500 wrenches stories were coming about.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, here's a good time. And then they were putting pressure on the people and the purchasers of the Navy to be more competitive. So I thought, this is perfect timing. I have people who want to sell products. I have people who need to be more competitive in their buying. So why not have some type of magazine that would bring the two together?
I don't know if our listeners appreciate that the founder of Military Business Review has written this new novel that is like wildly freakish and hallucinogenic.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain sides of my personality, I guess, that, you know, I really enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed writing this book, and I also enjoyed trying to put together this magazine for military business contractors. But I got tired of it, and I left, and here we are in New York.
Well, did it help your writing at all?
Absolutely not. It was just, again, it only helped my writing in the fact that I had money to do things that I wanted to do from the magazine and just kind of have a nice lifestyle in Virginia Beach for a while.
So what actually launched you as a writer?
I think that in my late 20s, as I was, when I was a newspaper reporter, I kept reading books that were getting all this acclaim, and I would read the books and I would think, well, I'm not so sure. And I felt that there should be books written that I would like to read, and I couldn't find them. So I thought, well, maybe I should try to write a book that I would like to read. Maybe I should write a couple of short stories that I would like to read, something sort of dark and tragic and funny. And when I was at the Navy News, I started writing these short stories and sending them to Esquire magazine. I thought that was the place to be. And they would come back and say, these are pretty good stories, but they need to be rewritten. And I'd go, look, I'm on deadline. I have ship of the week to do. I'll write you another one. How about that? So I'd write them another one. This went on for like 6 or 8 months. And finally, the fiction editor, Tom Jenks, at the time said, look, you know, you've just rewrite some of this stuff, you know. And I was going, no, I'll just rewrite. I'll write you another one. And it went on and on. And finally, we got together. He came down, was coming through Virginia. We met, and he said, if you really want to play hardball fiction, a good place to go is in New York. So, and I was tired of doing Ship of the Week and dining reviews and hanging out with the Admiral's wife at tea. So I came to New York, and I'd been seeing someone from New York. So I came up and said, here I am. So here I am.
My guest is writer Mark Richard. His new novel is called Fish Boy. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Mark Richard is my guest. He won the Penn Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award, and now he's written a new novel called Fish Boy. Listening to your voice now, I'm reminded that at the age of 13, you were a radio announcer. So I guess it's a little bit like coming home, right? Being
it's
on
great.
The microphone again.
I know. I love this.
Well, how did you manage to become a radio announcer at age 13?
Well, I tell the story that I came down from... I came down to breakfast one morning, and my mama had this wooden spoon, and she's standing in the doorway. She says, I've got some water boiling. Do you want some soft-boiled eggs or oatmeal? And I said, oatmeal. And, like, her eyes bugged because my voice had not changed. I mean, my voice changed overnight, literally, and it didn't crack like most boys' voices do. So she ran upstairs and got my father and brought him down. She says, tell your father what you want for breakfast. And I said, oatmeal. And he bugged out. And I guess my mom was upset because she had been raised Catholic. She maybe thought my head was getting ready to spin around or something. So the station manager of the local radio station lived across the street from us. And he told my father, he said, look, you know, your son could have a career in radio. And my father said, well, can he start today? And they took me down to the juvenile judge, who I would actually run into later under different circumstances. And they gave me one of those child release things. So in about 2 weeks, I was going pedaling my bicycle down the radio station with this voice at age 13 and doing commercials and voiceovers and stuff like that. And a couple of weeks after that, I had a radio show at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Mark Richard Show. Pretty original title. But I did that for like 5 years so that when I graduated at age 18, I had a resume and had done, broadcast, sports broadcasts of local high school football games and stuff like that. And had a really good time.
When you were 13, did they try to pass you off as an adult?
Well, it's such a small town, everyone kind of knew. And also, my voice having changed overnight, it was sort of like a phenomena that people would come over to the house to say, you know, they go, say something. You know, it's only a town of about 8,000, 9,000 people.
Uh-huh.
So, I really enjoyed it. I have two recurring dreams, and one of them is that, I'm in a studio just playing those old 45s and pulling news off the AP machine that's chattering in the background, and it was nice. And in a weird way, I'm wondering if that's not, if that's how I may have become interested in writing in some sense, because it kind of occurred to me that it's similar. You're in a room by yourself, you're speaking, you don't know if anyone's listening, and in oftentimes a small station, no one is. And you're trying to set some type of narrative up with music and chatter. And I swear sometimes when the writing is going really well, I have that sense of being alone in a radio booth and doing records and setting your own little program out, you know?
You're just creating a whole atmosphere.
Exactly.
What were your favorite records to play?
Well, at that time I was playing... This was AM station, and FM rock had not come around, so I was playing, Clapton and the Stones and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
This is 69 through 74, so the rock and roll of that era. But the weird thing was is that I had, they would send all the records that were out, and I would kind of hook on to these odd records like Captain Beefheart. And so I'm at this little southern radio station between the farm market report and weather, and I'm playing Captain Beefheart, you know, and people would call up and were going, what is this you're playing on the radio? And I was going, it's Captain Beefheart. I don't know anything about him either, but I kind of like it. So there was a lot of everything on the radio at that time.
It's funny. It's like you were running a little college station on your shift.
Yeah, and 13, 14 years old.
Yeah. So you said you got to see this judge at a later date for a different reason, the judge who gave you the working papers.
Oh, right, yeah.
What happened?
Well, it's a small town. There wasn't a lot to do, and he'd, get in trouble sometimes. The first time I saw him, I was in there for assaulting a police officer. A friend of mine and I had gotten some of these water pistols and were riding around, and I don't know what we were thinking, if we could get away with this, but we kind of went up and shot these policemen, and they didn't think it was real funny. So they took us down and put us in jail, and I had to go and talk to the judge. And and then we had to go to court and everything, which is really wild. And the cops came in. They felt bad about it because they kind of roughed us up at the police station. And it kind of got back to the judge that they had roughed us up a little bit. And one of the policemen said, well, I know what it's like to be young. Shoot, when I was a kid, I used to throw potatoes at the mail truck. So... they kind of let us off for that, and we were on probation, and the worst thing they made us do was wash a bunch of police cars or something like that. But, it's like Mayberry in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Just Mayberry with an edge, and Captain Beefheart.
One of the things that set you apart when you were young is that you were in the hospital for some time because
right.
of your problem with your hips. What was the problem?
It was probably a congenital condition that seems to run in my mother's side of the family. Of just the balls are not in the sockets correctly, and they go in and do all this breaking and putting in pins. And My father was a forester. He worked out in the woods just marking trees and stuff and didn't have a lot of money, so I ended up going to these charity hospitals. And, the things they were doing then, in a charity hospital, you have to understand that you are a guinea pig for the people who are starting to practice surgery, and for better or for worse. And these are things you don't understand until you're an adult. And that is when I started to read a lot, when I was in and out of the hospitals a lot, and also saw these poor, poor people, a lot of them from Appalachia and from the back tidewater regions, of these horribly disfigured children who were, your playmates and in the next bed next to you. And someone asked me the other day about the grotesqueries in this book, Fishboy, and I think part of the thing is that as a child, most of my playmates in these hospitals were these horribly disfigured people, but you didn't flinch. They were your playmates, and you'd look at their face and you couldn't discern eyes or nose or mouth or something like that, but you didn't flinch when you looked at these people. And I think that's an important aspect for a writer, is to be able to have compassion for people who are like that and not flinch, though, when you look at them. You don't flinch at all. You should not.
Why were so many of the children in this hospital disfigured?
A lot of them were birth defects from, malnutrition. And different times of the year, they would have different clinics. Like for part of the summer, they have burn clinics. So children that had been horribly burned would come in. Children with brain tumors would come in, or, whatever the category was. And since I was in there for a long period of time in a body cast, I would see the turnover of the different types of child problems. And you think you've got problems, and you see, some child that's head is the size of a bushel basket, being wheeled in on some sort of truck, or some kid from Appalachia comes in and his cast is opened up and it's just like infested with roaches and stuff. I mean, you just, things you can't imagine.
Did that terrify you?
I think as a child we have some sort of survival mechanism against these things that now it's more frightening to me now when I think about them than they were when I saw them as a child. As a child, I was thinking, this is something, but I didn't know what it was. And I had playmates that they would, and I've started to write about this a little more recently, that you'd have playmates and they would be wheeled out and they'd come back and they wouldn't have their legs anymore, and you just go, that's something. And you just, I don't know, it's more terrifying now than it was as a child.
It does sound like the experiences in that hospital really did have a lingering impact and affect the characters in your new novel.
Right. I think I don't know how yet, though, Terry. I haven't figured it out. But I do know that I've put forth these grotesqueries, but they are complete. They're not incomplete because of their lack of some body part or lack of some part of their brain, but they are complete humans in a way. They are living in the world. They are part of the human condition. They are human condition.
Marc Richard, his new novel is called Fishboy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I love you, big dummy. I love you, big dummy. Nobody has love. Love has nobody. I love you, big dummy. Breathe deep. Breathe high. Breathe life. Don't breathe alive. I love you, big dummy.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon. He's worked with everyone from Lenny Bruce to Merv Griffin, not to mention Chet Baker, Art Pepper, Stan Kenton, Benny Goodman, Jimmy Giuffre, Frank Sinatra, and Tony Bennett. If you remember him from his clowning with the Merv Griffin Band, you'll be very surprised by the emotional depth and vulnerability on his new record. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House is saying that it still hopes to have an announcement on a Supreme Court justice by the end of this week, and sources say the president has narrowed his list of finalists to two. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
According to administration and Capitol Hill sources, the president has switched directions and is now leaning towards naming federal judge Stephen Breyer to the Supreme Court. As late as yesterday, the president was said to be almost certain that his pick would be Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. But environmental groups and members of Congress have been protesting to the president that Babbitt is too valuable to the administration where he is at Interior. And some Republicans have attacked Babbitt as being too political. So Mr. Clinton, sorely in need of a quick win on Capitol Hill, is said now to be leaning towards Judge Breyer. Breyer, who served as chief counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee in the late 1970s, has been praised by Republicans on the committee and is the protege of Senator Edward Kennedy, who would shepherd his nomination through the Senate. Said one White House source, the decision is not final yet, but Breyer is almost a done deal, and sources close to Bruce Babbitt say he is depressed. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
President Clinton has invited the Congressional Black Caucus to the White House tomorrow in an effort to heal wounds created by his withdrawal of support for Lonnie Grenier for the top civil rights job at the Department of Justice. However, today, the Black Caucus said it would not meet with Mr. Clinton tomorrow. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The caucus is not just upset about Lonnie Grenier. There is also concern that their other priorities are getting short shrift. They hope to send a message that they, the Black Caucus, are determined to play a role in the budget package now before the Senate. Caucus Chairman Kwaisi Nfume, a Maryland Democrat, said a number of items, such as the summer jobs program, are non-negotiable.
The idea of severely reducing the amount of money available for that, in light of the fact that summer is almost already here, is something that we want to communicate to this administration, to the Senate leadership, and to the House leadership, becomes, to, in some respects, a point of non-negotiation.
Nfume also said the caucus would not accept any additional major cuts in entitlement programs. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
In Bosnia, fighting has intensified between Muslim and Croatian forces in the central part of the country. Efforts to stop the fighting are underway, with a UN-sponsored meeting planned in Geneva this weekend. While both sides have been allies in the past, now a struggle for territory has driven them to opposing sides. For weeks, UN peacekeepers in the region had warned that Muslim forces would fight for land around Travnik. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 1 point to close at 3,511. This is NPR News. President Clinton and top Senate Democrats have reportedly agreed tentatively to a new budget plan that changes Mr. Clinton's energy tax to a smaller tax. Congressional sources have told the Associated Press the new plan calls for a tax on transportation fuels and electrical power. Under the new plan, $20 billion in lost revenue would be made up for by cuts in Medicare and Medicaid. Mr. Clinton's plan to add to the food stamp program and to grant tax credits to the working poor would be trimmed. Under the tentative proposal, Mr. Clinton's plan to raise tax rates on the wealthiest taxpayers to 36% would be delayed from January 1st. On Capitol Hill, a tape of the early moments of the first federal raid on the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas, was released today at a congressional hearing. NPR's Andy Bowers has more on the story.
Shortly after agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms stumbled into an ambush by cult leader David Koresh and his followers, one of those followers called 911 in an apparent effort to begin negotiations. Throughout the next 30 minutes, a Waco, Texas sheriff's official tried to keep the Branch Davidians on the phone while unsuccessfully attempting to contact the ATF agents outside the compound. The sound of shooting can be heard throughout.
Who's firing now?
They are!
All right, stand by. I'm trying to reach them. Stand, don't return fire, okay?
We haven't been.
What?
We haven't been.
Okay.
Also at today's hearing, the director of the ATF said agents were under specific orders not to conduct the February raid if the element of surprise was lost. He said the investigation continues into how Koresh did learn of the raid in advance. I'm Andy Bowers at the Capitol.
Both the U.S. and France have sent in reinforcements to the capital of Somalia in the wake of the killing of 23 U.N. peacekeepers. French tanks and troop carriers arrived today from Badoa. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz musician Jack Sheldon has played trumpet, sung, and cracked jokes in many different settings. He's been a featured soloist with Sinatra, Bennett, Goodman, Basie, and Gillespie. His bandmates have included Chet Baker, Art Pepper, and Zoot Sims. Sheldon has played on the soundtracks of nearly four dozen films, including The Porn Broker, The Pink Panther, and White Men Can't Jump. And he recorded the very first rendition of The Shadow of Your Smile for the film The Sandpiper. Then there's the TV themes he played on for The Munsters and Peter Gunn. And for 18 years, Sheldon was resident comedian in the band for The Merv Griffin Show. Now he leads a big band in Southern California. Jack Sheldon's most recent recording, On My Own, on the Concord Jazz label, presents him in a surprisingly intimate and emotionally exposed setting. The album features a series of duets with pianist Ross Tompkins.
This love of mine goes on and on. Though life is empty since you have gone, you're always on my mind. Though out of sight, it's lonely through the day, but all the night I cry my heart out, it will surely break. Since nothing matters, just let it break. I ask the sun and the moon, the stars that shine, what's to become of it? This love of mine.
Jack Sheldon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
I don't know why I had this image of you, but I always thought of you as somebody who relied a lot on humor in their singing and music. And there's something so emotionally naked about some of the songs on your new record that really surprised me. I really love the singing and the playing on it. Is the choice of material or the kind of singing that you're doing a relatively recent development with you?
The kind of ballad I've been trying. I think I'm singing better now. I'm studying singing, and so I just can do it better. But I've been doing it all my life, and it's more naked, I think. I like that, emotionally naked. That's good. But I guess I'm just developing into where I can do more personal, you know, stuff and better pitch and just things I've been working on. And studying it, too, helps.
Well, that's interesting. Tell me what you're getting from learning how to sing. I mean, taking formal lessons.
Well, just real simple stuff. But, you know, to have a lot of foundation, get a lot of air and use your diaphragm. And I notice now when I... if I'm having trouble with a note, it's really because I don't have the foundation there to, you know, get a lot of air in my stomach and my diaphragm and to open my mouth wide. You just learn real simple things that you think you do, but you don't really. And then practice the pitch and the articulation. It's just things like the trumpet with, you know, hitting every note precisely in pitch and... it's just doing things, you know, to have somebody keep telling you. It's good to take lessons and study like that because then you have you do what you do and then somebody can criticize you and in a nice way. They're real nice to me and they're real encouraging.
Was there another change that happened to you besides taking lessons? Did something happen emotionally that left you more open to this kind of material?
Well, I got sober 8 years ago, and I don't drink or take drugs or do anything like that, and I think that left me teachable. Before that, I thought I was really cool, and I knew everything. So, and I didn't want to take lessons. I thought I was better than the teachers, you know, and I really just didn't know what I was doing. And then when I got sober, I found out there was a lot of stuff that I didn't know and that people didn't use me, not because they didn't like me or anything, because I couldn't produce what they wanted. Now I'm trying to get to be able to do anything any composer might want.
When you were playing in the 1950s, bop was the thing, and very few of the instrumentalists sang. Did you sing back then, and were you self-conscious about singing at all?
Yeah, I was always self-conscious about singing. I wanted to sing, but it's so personal, singing. And I started singing with Benny Goodman's band, and that was about 1958. And I wrote a song, and Benny let me sing. He was the first band leader that would ever let me sing. Stan Kenton wouldn't let me sing, though, because he always was afraid I would say something too off-color, which I probably would have.
Did you have a reputation for doing that?
Yes. I worked with Lenny Bruce, and I was trying to kind of emulate him at the time.
What kind of work did you do with Lenny Bruce? You were in the band playing at the club or something?
Yeah, in burlesque, I worked with Lenny Bruce. We worked with his wife, Honey, and Joe Maney, and Philly Joe Jones, and Kenny Drew, and Leroy Vinegar. We had quite a real good band there. And we played burlesque at a place called Duffy's in Los Angeles. And Lenny was the comic, and we did all kind of, he would write stuff, and we'd act out. We did The Man with the Golden Arm. And
oh, really? Like your own version of that?
Yeah, a burlesque version.
Well, that must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was funny, I think. I think it ended up where the guy flushed the dope down the toilet, and then Lenny said, there's only one thing to do is smoke the toilet. It doesn't sound so funny now. You really had to be there, I guess.
Trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon is my guest. His latest album is called On My Own. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter and singer Jack Sheldon is my guest. It's interesting to me, you know, you're taking lessons now in singing and trumpet, and I'm glad for the fact that you're not becoming overly obsessive in your performance on technique. I mean, you still, like, play trumpet solos in which there's kind of clear ringing notes, but also these, like, wonderful, like, smudged, arpeggiated kind of figures. You know what I mean? I'd hate for you to give that up just because you're learning good technique.
I'm going to have that smudge for life, I guess. My teacher says that. He says, I don't want to ruin your style or anything, but I don't think there's much chance of that. I would like to get as clean as I can, but the smudge is there. I think it's in my bones.
Why don't I play another track from your latest album, On My Own? And I thought I'd play some of I Can't Get Started because it kind of shows off everything, your trumpet playing, your singing, and it shows both like the emotionalism of your singing and also some of the humor in it too.
Okay, thanks. I've flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted, still I can't get started with you. Around the golf course I'm under par, and Benny Goodman made me a star. I had a house, a show place. Now she got that and I got no place, and I also can't get started with you. You're so supreme.
That's Jack Sheldon on trumpet and vocals from his new album, On My Own. There's a really interesting documentary about the trumpeter Chet Baker that you were featured in. You were one of the people interviewed about Baker. And I remember you saying that, and I should mention that like you, Chet Baker played trumpet and sang. And you were very funny about him. You talked a little bit about how frustrating it was that he never, you were always in room rehearsing, you're practicing, and he never had a practice or anything. He always just had the sound, and he always looked
he
so
did.
Great.
I hear Harry James never had to practice. But I have to practice all the time. Doc Severinsen practices all the time. But, I was singing back there with Chetty when we were little kids, come to think of it. We were both singing, and we'd sing together, and we grew up together. And we would sing. We had a little quartet. We'd go around and play in little bars for $2 or anything we'd get. We just would drive up. The bass player, Hirsch Hamel, had a Pierce Arrow, and we'd have the bass in there, and it was a 12-cylinder old car with a place for a chauffeur and everything.
How old were you then?
Oh, I was about 14, 15. I was about 15. No, 16, I guess.
And how did you...
Because I was in Florida when I was 14. I was 16, and Chetty was about, I think, about 18 or 19.
How did you meet?
I think at a place called the Showtime, which was on Sepulveda and Ventura Boulevard, and it was a jam session on Monday nights, and all the guys that were on the road would come in there. I got to play with Art Blakey in there, and Stan Kenton, and a bunch of people. Maynard Ferguson would come in there, and Chetty and I would always just sit in. To me, it was, the glittering night of stars of jazz, and I was just thrilled to be there.
Now, how did you get to the West Coast from Florida, where you grew up?
Well, my aunt came out here first from Florida, and she was a swimming teacher. Crystal Scarborough was her name, and she taught babies how to swim. And then we moved out here, and my mother started teaching swimming, and I taught swimming, too. And we got a pool on Hollywood Boulevard. My mother taught all the movie stars' kids how to swim. Paul Newman and Lee Remick, every movie star at the time, Nat Cole. I taught Natalie and Kelly Cole how to swim.
Really?
And used to have Kelly in the pool with me, and Nat Cole would be walking around the pool smoking cigarettes. He was a chain smoker. And I'd have Kelly sing, "When the blue of the night meets the gold of the day," Bing Crosby's theme song, and Nat would go, ha, ha, ha. But it was slightly humorous. But I taught a lot of kids. I taught all of Paul Newman's kids. In fact, one of his daughters used to bite me on the ankle when I'd be talking to Joanne Woodward.
How old were you when you started working professionally when you started playing with other bands?
I was 12 in Jacksonville, Florida. And I just started playing the trumpet, and I started working with Gene Brandt's band at the Washington Hotel there. Everybody was gone in the war. And... So I started working, and then I came to California and started college at 16. I started to go to USC, and then I switched over to City College because they had such a good music department. So I went to college there for a couple of years, and then I joined the Air Force. And then I got out of the Air Force, and I worked a lot with Mexican bands. I worked at Million Dollar Theater downtown Los Angeles, all Mexican shows. And then I went in the, I joined Stan Kenton, and went around, went to New York and played at Birdland with Stan Kenton. And Chet Baker was already there in New York, and he was already acting real wild. He played opposite Miles Davis, and this threw him off. Before he went to New York, he would smoke grass sometimes, but then he got all involved in heroin and everything else in New York. And then, he got really messed up then, and he never really was the same after that, because he was a great kid. And then he got too wild, but he always was a great genius of a trumpet player.
I want to ask you something else about your sound. Do you think that there's a connection between the way you sing and the way you play trumpet?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Just, all the wrong things I do on the trumpet, I do with the voice, too. But I'm trying to eliminate that now and get... I want my pitch to be better and my preciseness. Now, that's what I'm getting with my lessons. You know, in jazz, we can hit a note and go, kind of come up to it. And in classical music, you have to be precisely on the pitch, singing and playing the trumpet. And this is something that I never really watched when I was... I always had pretty good pitch, but I would, come up to notes or go down to them. And the classical music, my teacher's always stopping me and say, no, right on the pitch, hit the note on the pitch and do... Anytime I make a mistake, too, he has me go back and start again.
Do you ever worry that you'll lose some of the... jazz flavor or rhythm or intonation of your music?
I don't think so. No, it's just I think it's really just helped me and made me much better. I don't think you can get too good. It just helps really. It's I found it that way. My teacher's always saying, I don't want to take anything away from you, but I think it just helps. Mm-hmm. If anything, it just makes you more efficient and competent.
Jack Sheldon, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm so flattered you had me on. It's a thrill. I love your show, and it's a great show, and thank you very much.
Jack Sheldon's latest album is called On My Own. It's on Concord Records. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel from All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing from John Idsty about the latest changes in President Clinton's economic program. Members of the administration and the Senate leadership are reaching a new compromise on the tax on energy, shifting from a tax on British thermal units to a tax on the costs of energy. We'll be hearing what that means later on in the program. Also today, David Molpis reports on the ethical problems surrounding Alabama's new governor, who took office after Alabama's old governor left under a cloud of ethical problems. A talk with Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles about the new mayor of that city, and a report on California's workfare program and how it's working. Coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
One of our proudest moments on Fresh Air was the concert we presented last month with singer and songwriter Arthur Alexander. We all love his new record, and we're proud to play some small part in his much-deserved comeback. That's why we were so saddened today to hear the news. Arthur Alexander died early this morning after suffering a heart attack on Monday. He was 53. He died in Nashville, where he had performed over the weekend. That concert was to kick off a summer tour, which would have included a performance in New York Central Park. It was the beginning of a brand new chapter in his life. He had given up performing in the 70s, in part because he was tired of being financially exploited. Since then, he'd been driving a bus for a community center in Cleveland. Back in the 60s, he was best known for his songs Anna, which was recorded by the Beatles, and You Better Move On, which was recorded by the Rolling Stones. Alexander was recently coaxed back into the recording studio by Danny Kahn of Elektra Records. It seems terribly unfair that Alexander leaves us just as this new record was bringing him the praise and recognition he deserved. But we take some comfort in knowing that his music was given new life, and he lived long enough to see how much pleasure his new record brought to old and new fans. This is the title track of his new record, Lonely Just Like Me.
For my name, just call me lonely, and my past, just say it's bad. But the story I'm about to tell you may sound a little sad. Well, I've never had nothing. All I ever owned was me. I was about to lose myself, and then I met Mary. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling. Darling, don't you cry for me, 'cause I will only make you lonely. Lonely just like me. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling. Oh, my darling, now can't you see? Just say goodbye, I'll understand it, and walk away from me. But my darling, she wouldn't listen. She said, boy, you shut your mouth. Love each other, they should try and work it out. So I listen to my Mary, and my life was filled with glee. But one night at a party, some bad luck came to me. There was a guy messing with my Mary, and I begged him to let her be. All I could hear was my Mary crying, because he placed his knife in me. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling. Darling, don't you cry for me, 'cause I will only make you lonely. Lonely just like me. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling. Oh, my darling, now can't you see? Just say goodbye, I'll understand it, and walk away from me. Just say goodbye, I'll understand it, and walk away from me.
Arthur Alexander from his new album, Lonely Just Like Me. Arthur Alexander died today at the age of 53. All of us at Fresh Air feel privileged to have had the chance to meet him and work with him. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singing the songs you believe in, we talk with Abby Lincoln. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Some folks talk about my power. Some folks say I'm wild and strong. Others say my style of living makes a man go wrong.